Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, September 28, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on Going Dark and the intersection of law enforcement and privacy interests. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome Professor Peter Swire of Alston and Byrd and Georgia Tech's Scheller Caller of Business and Benjamin Wittes of the Brookings Institution. More complete bios of both experts were provided to you in the notice of today's call, so we'll stop here and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. With that, Mr. Wittes, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much. So I want to start by saying that this is actually not an issue that I have, sort of strong normative feelings about what the right answer is. It's an issue that I think is genuinely very difficult and relies to assess what the right answer is on a whole lot of data that we actually don't have access to. And so what I would like to do, not because it's a secret, actually, but because it really doesn't exist. And so what I would like to do is to explain why I think the problem is very difficult, explain what my conceptual beliefs are, and why the realities may not well comport with them. And then explain what the missing data is that would enable us, I think, better to understand the way forward. So I apologize in advance if this is not a sort of, strongly hortatory normative talk, but consider it a work in progress. So the basic problem is that we are living in a golden age of communications. And that enables a great deal of surveillance that didn't used to be possible. Surveillance involves both, surveillance of aggregate or data about communications, that what we call metadata. But it also involves more traditional wiretaps, what we would call content. Collection, that is the substance of voice communications, the substance of relay chat communications, the substance of, all of these many device-to-device communications, as well as large storage capability on very small devices. This has enabled a whole lot of activity of which we're all aware, most of it wonderful, and a small amount of it, particularly in the child exploitation and terrorism areas, very scary and very threatening. The FBI director has said publicly that there are open ISIS investigations in all 50 states. And that a consistent pattern in all of these in many of these investigations is that people get recruited get involved in ISIS in public forums like Twitter. And then as soon as they show an interest, they get routed into services that involve end-to-end encryption of communication. So think of things like WhatsApp, services like Telegram and Signal, as well as, the Apple suite of communications, FaceTime, iMessage, which, these services to one degree or another have very strong encryption that even the companies themselves cannot necessarily decrypt unless you configure your account in particular ways. And the result of that is that there comes a point in the interaction between the terrorist group or criminal organization or, you know, child pornography dealer and the client where they can communicate in fashions that are quite secure and fairly now ubiquitously available. Now, a couple of side points. There's nothing especially new about the ability to engage in secure communications, at least since the early 90s when PGP became available. Somebody who wanted to, you know, send encrypted emails or even sort of encrypted voice communications, it was doable. The problem is that the network effects all militated against it. So to send a secure communication, you had to have somebody on the other end who was also competent to use not terribly difficult software, but reasonably difficult software to use compared to not using it. And the result was that relatively few people actually did it. I have had on every email that I've sent for the last several years a link for people who want to send me PGP encrypted email. I send out my public key. I have never received a encrypted email communication using that public key. And so the problem was quite theoretical until relatively recently when companies, largely in response to the Snowden investigations, began building default encryption, strong encryption, end-to-end into their systems. And that created really two distinct problems. One is the problem of you seize a computer or a phone from the child pornographer and you actually can't access the contents of it. So that's the data at rest problem. And the second problem is the data in motion problem. You have a lawful wiretap order, you collect the signal, and you cannot interpret the signal. So I think what is fair to say is that this problem is A, real, B, growing, and C, growing very, very quickly now that these encryption settings are in some services the default. And as certain highly encrypted services, particularly WhatsApp, really catch fire overseas. So the proposed solution, which is some regulatory requirement that companies that engage in the distribution of these systems, making these systems available, have some what the FBI would call provision for lawful access and what people disparagingly in the cybersecurity world will call backdoors access for the Bureau, for maybe for the intelligence community, when they have lawful process from courts, either under Title III or under FISA. And the problem, and here is where the issue I think gets very hard, conceptually, I'm very sympathetic to this. You know, I don't really see why Apple should be making phones that even with appropriate court process cannot be wiretapped. The problem is that the creation of these of solutions to this problem necessarily involve the creation of vulnerabilities in systems that could be more secure. And those vulnerabilities are themselves ripe for attack by bad actors as well as with lawful process, the FBI and the intelligence community. Moreover, other countries will want to create similar regulatory requirements, forcing systems to be less secure than they would otherwise be. And so the problem is you don't know whether you are mandating greater insecurity than you are adding security to the system by preserving the ability to wiretap. The result is that the companies, which are, of course, now trying desperately to establish that they are not simply in bed with the NSA, are very, very opposed to any regime that would require access. And and nobody has come up with a way of demonstrating either that the net impact on security is positive, or that there is some really sort of good way to mitigate the security vulnerabilities that you may create. So what is the missing data? I will give a brief sketch of the missing data and then stop and turn it over to Peter Swier. To me, I accept the proposition that you need to know that to effectuate a reasonable lawful access regime, you have to have you will have to create additional vulnerabilities. All new features, right, create vulnerabilities, and new features that are designed to create vulnerabilities to the FBI can be reasonably be expected to create vulnerabilities for other actors. The question, and I think it's a very hard question, is whether how long, how quickly, and how completely you would expect those new vulnerabilities to be actuated by bad actors. So I think you might feel very differently about it if you could say, all right, Facebook, Apple, we have an algorithm that we do not believe reasonably will be compromised in 100 years. Well, after that, we're not promising. Then if you say we have an algorithm that will, you know, not survive, you know, for more than 100 days. And while the tech community has invested a lot of rhetorical energy into insisting that this is not doable, what it hasn't said is what the margin of error is, because that's a body of research that it really hasn't done. You know, how long would what this kind of system, could it reasonably be expected to remain secure? And I think without knowing the answer to that question, it is very, very difficult to say either yes, these sort of long-term access regimes, the lawful access regimes, are ones we should pursue as a regulatory matter, or whether we should simply say, hey, you know, we're going to accept that there is going to be communications on which, even with lawful process, we're entirely blind. And I will say, and let me close here, you know, there are costs either way. I do think, you know, if you're thinking about this purely in a cybersecurity framework, the right answer is to not build in any vulnerabilities you don't have to, and to make systems as secure absolutely as you can. But people in the tech community who feel that way as a matter of sort of purity of systems and purity of technical architecture should not kid themselves that will not have enormous costs and real costs, both in the area of you know, national security and terrorism, and in a lot of child exploitation cases.
Okay, I think that's my cue. So hi, this is Peter Swier, and thanks to Ben and to the Federal Society for hosting this today. I was a student at Yale Law School in the early 80s when the Federalist Society was just getting going. I clerked for Ralph Winter, who was the first faculty advisor to the first Federalist Society chapter. And I've respected how the Society has often reached out to people with different perspectives to debate these interesting issues. So I've been working on encryption for a really long time. In the 1999, it was illegal to export strong encryption from the United States. At that time, I was working in the U.S. Office of Management and Budget, and they had me as a sort of tech-oriented lawyer chair the White House working group on what to do about encryption. And as a result of that process in 1999, the government decided that we should allow export of strong encryption. There would be disadvantages to the FBI and intelligence agencies, but the problems with trying to regulate effective encryption were so great on the internet that we really couldn't survive it. And the basic points from that period still exist today. So, for instance, on the internet, when Alice is sending something to Bob, there's lots of nodes in between that can grab the bits and look at them. If you do it in plain text, then all sorts of malicious actors can read communications on the internet. And so that's why everyone has shifted over time to having encryption between Alice and Bob so that the bad guys in the middle don't get to read all the messages or copy all the bank transfers or whatever it is. So fundamentally on the internet, having anything except encryption is bad practice. And in a globalized world that we live in now, we have to figure out what the procedures are going to be as the FBI and others ask for this extraordinary access. So I have a few points to make that I'll get to in the initial points, and then we'll probably in the questions touch on a lot of other things. One of the things is that the law enforcement folks, including FBI Director Comey, very sincerely concerned about the problems we just heard Ben articulate, is that the worry is that the FBI and other law enforcement people are going dark, that before they could see the messages and now a shield of cloaking of dark encryption has covered over it, and so now they've gone dark. And what I've written, and it's a meme that's been picked up a fair bit in the debates, is that instead, really, we're in what I call a golden age of surveillance, that we're in a period where rather than there being growing problems for law enforcement, there are growing advantages for law enforcement, unparalleled, really, in human history. And so if you're trying to think about a limited government or checks and balances on government, it's important to get that factual context. Here's three reasons to think that. First is location information. So now, for the first time in human history, pretty much all of us pretty much always carry a tracking device. That's what our cell phone is. And so if you're investigating a person or a conspiracy, having the location of people is tremendously useful. Second, it really helps law enforcement to know who the co-conspirators and confederates are. So now law enforcement can see our social network people, the people we text, the people we're in communication with in so many ways. And that kind of very granular mapping of all of our interactions gives a suspect list for any time we have a suspect, who else might be a suspect. That's a huge advantage for law enforcement. And then third, as we head towards the Internet of Things and as we head towards big data, the number of other databases, the number of other data points about an individual is exponentially through the roof. That's what I teach in privacy and cybersecurity. And so when you have location on people, when you know who their confederates are, and when it's basically impossible for them to hide in a big data Internet of Things world, this is the brightest period for surveillance we've ever seen. Now, law enforcement correctly says that they're losing something, that if there's a text message through WhatsApp, that is end-to-end encrypted, and so if they intercept it online that Alice is communicating with Bob, they can't read the content. But, you know, here's the history of text messages over the last 20 years. For some testimony that I did for the Senate in the same hearing as FBI Commissioner Comey, I looked up and saw that right now we're well over 6 trillion text messages a year. All the metadata about that is available to law enforcement, who has texted who, when, and how long it is. And if you think about the glass half empty or half full, law enforcement compared to 20 years ago has a glass full of 6 trillion text messages. And instead, they're saying it's empty. Instead, it's not half full or half empty. They're claiming it's all empty. But instead, they have a mobilization of data about our communications that's never been possible in history before. So that's the golden age of surveillance point. I'll make one other point and then stop, and we can do a lot of discussion. I think one of the big questions is, if we have mandated vulnerabilities, if we have mandated openings to law enforcement in the United States, that threatens U.S. technological leadership without preventing the bad guys from using strong encryption. So the way to think about it here is that today there's open source software for encryption that's very widely used. If the United States were to say you're not supposed to use any of the encryption except when we allowed it, that's actually going to still be available from suppliers overseas and from open source suppliers to have the fully effective encryption. When the FBI gets a device or gets a communication that's encrypted, people who want to hide it have it available. And what we will have done is taken away from the U.S. companies that have technological leadership the ability to sell their products and services globally. We're really pushing other countries in the world to get that technological leadership. And we don't actually stop the strong encryption from happening. The fundamental problem in our globalized setting is that when you do the vulnerability, it's not going to be 100 years till somebody has the back door to it. This is something we sometimes call the least trusted country problem. Imagine, if you will, the country you trust least in the world, you know, Iran, Pakistan, China, Russia, whoever your favorite country is that you trust the least. If we have mandated vulnerabilities, for instance, the United States pressuring our companies to have mandated vulnerabilities, then the Pakistani government will insist that they have the same access the FBI has. And by the way, once they have access to it, that secret's not going to stay secret long in terms of what the vulnerabilities are. There's going to be corruption and there's going to be leaks from governments around the world. So it's not an FBI game of the FBI seeing it. It's all the governments around the world, including the ones you trust the least, getting it. And it's that kind of mandated vulnerability that just seems so inconceivable as correct policy when you put the encryption in the globalized setting. So I've been working for a lot of years in this field. I think mandated vulnerabilities is a bad idea for multiple reasons. Fortunately, FBI Director Comey gets an awful lot of metadata and other good things he never had before, and we should see it as the advantage he's under rather than a disadvantage. So I'll stop there.
Mr. Wittes, do you want to respond to anything that Professor Swire just said?
Yeah, so I will respond only briefly to one point, which is that I think to describe the current period as a golden age of surveillance misses something important, which is that, you know, people who do law enforcement do not feel this as a golden age of surveillance. They feel this as a world in which they are awash in modalities of communication. People have more and more communications options. It's harder, not easier, to know what people are doing unless you happen to have a very specific target that you are then able to gather on. And, you know, so I think it is true that there's a lot more data available about people, but it's also true that you can get very lost in that, and that same set of forces that creates the opportunities to do that also creates opportunities for individuals to use a bunch of different devices, a bunch of different apps that, you know, send communications in different ways. And so I think the better way to understand it is really that we're in a golden age of communications. And I think the reason that the Bureau is so terrified of encryption and, you know, end-to-end strong encryption is that, you know, it creates a environment in which for the first time in their history, you could have large sectors of communications contents across many different platforms that they are, you know, blind to. And while it is fair to say that, hey, they do have access to a huge amount of metadata, which of course cannot be encrypted because metadata is what's used to deliver the content, right? I think the fear of relying on that exclusively is not unjustified. And so I think the golden age of surveillance is a two-edged sword, right? On the one hand, there's a lot you can gather, but the other thing is that what's enabling that is many communications options, which create a kind of cat and mouse game for law enforcement and people who want to evade it.
Can I just briefly, on that, I think that there is a lot of complexity facing law enforcement, and I actually am in favor of having technical assistance and better technologists and better technologist funding for the FBI and the intelligence agencies in a lot of ways in order for them to find out what they can get out of current technology. And I think that's a very different thing, sympathizing with the challenges they're facing, from saying we should mandate the vulnerabilities. An awful lot of the easy, low-hanging fruit would come from having more good technologists helping get the data that's available today.
Well, let's go ahead and open the floor to audience questions before we continue with this back and forth here. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that says the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then pound. Again, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keypad. We will answer questions in the order they are received, and we do have one question now. Are we ready to take this question from the audience?
Hey, good afternoon. This is Mike Doherty with LabMD in Atlanta. One day I hope to meet Professor Swire, by the way. And I apologize, I've been on this thing for 5 minutes because I was stuck on another conference call. But the curious question I had from the beginning of seeing this is the political impact of Snowden and WikiLeaks and Assange, and because I speak on cybersecurity a lot, and there's a layperson's I think unjust, overblown anxiety of what the NSA is doing compared to other agencies. And it really falls out of the criminal into like the civil sector is what our rights are, especially the Fourth and Fifth Amendment. So I wondered if you could speak to how do you feel the political pushback and is going to impact getting these agencies what they need to keep us safe in national security?
Well, I can take a crack at that. So, look, the political impact of Snowden has been huge in this area, and it has been in many ways the precipitating set of events for the whole thing because, the sequence, and I think this is a reasonably neutral politically description of the sequence of events, in response to the initial group of Snowden revelations, NSA and the Obama administration more generally made the following argument, which is you can trust us in our handling of this material because, we have all these wonderful protections in the law that we scrupulously honor for U.S. persons. Now, this was extremely reassuring for people like me. But if you happen to be part of the 95% of the world who are not U.S. persons, this turns out to not have quite the same ring to it. And the problem from the point of view of U.S. companies is that their major growth opportunities are not among U.S. persons. They're, what the NSA calls targets, they call customers. And so the defense that the government used, which was proper under the law, by the way, because that is actually the most basic set of protections that the rule of law in this area tried to envision, and to my mind, rather successfully. But the problem was that defense was exactly what the rest of the world and therefore U.S. industry did not want to hear. And so U.S. industry responded to it by trying to reassure overseas customers that they were not in bed with NSA. And encryption was an essential piece of that response. Now, whether you think it's a good idea for them to be doing this end-to-end encryption or a bad idea, and as I've said, my views on that are really complicated because it solves a lot of important problems. The impact was to bring to the present a set of issues that have been, as Peter Swire said, out there for a long time. They've been around. They're not really new. And by making them the defaults in a lot of these systems, they really moved forward the confrontation from something that was theoretical and only affected users who really kind of knew what they were doing to kind of something much closer to average use of average systems. So yeah, I think the political impact of the Snowden revelations is very significant in driving this whole thing.
I agree with that, though I think that more was happening before June 2013 when the Snowden stories first hit than most people have seen. It was a highly specialized topic. I was writing long papers on encryption and globalization in 2011 and 2012. And my 2012 paper, again, this is before Snowden, was why encryption is driving law enforcement to go to the cloud, because there were already so many kinds of encrypted communications between Alice and Bob that you couldn't get their stuff a lot of time, and so you had to go to Gmail or go to Redmond or whatever to get the thing. So we were actually on this path to this debate, and there were proposals floating around similar to Comey's proposals if you go and look in 2011 and 12. But it was a sort of subspecialty for certain kinds of nerds. And what happened after Snowden is that the awareness of the issue became much bigger, and the importance of the reputation for tech companies became a lot bigger, I think.
Well, while we wait to see if we have any additional questions, and we would love to hear from you if you hit star and the pound key, I want to take a moment to make a quick programming note here. Our next scheduled teleforum will take place tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern Time. We'll be discussing proposed changes to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure as they relate to class actions. That call will feature Professor Brian Fitzpatrick and Mary Masseron. It looks like we do have one more question now, and we will go to that caller.
Hi, my name is Tom Lillis. I live in Greensboro, North Carolina. I'm one of those computer nerds that moved into law, and I still have problems getting around. There's been a philosophical leap here. I am a law-abiding person engaged in legal activities, and now I'm supposed to change what I'm doing to I'm being burdened by a law enforcement requirement that's considered a priori to be more important than my law-abiding ways. And I hope the panelists can address, are you worried that of this change, that we're supposed to change our law, even if we're law-abiding, we're supposed to do this on the behalf of law enforcement? It, from a technical standpoint, it strikes me as this is maintaining shortcuts at extreme price for law enforcement people, just because they've had this ability for a relatively short period. Do we really want to throw out the baby with the bathwater so they can maintain this? After all, human beings cannot read encrypted material. It needs to be decrypted at some level, and maybe they should be moving more into human intelligence rather than relying on technology.
Maybe I can take a shot at this. This is Peter Swire, and remember, I've been on a view where all things considered, I've decided I don't think law enforcement should get these mandates. But when you talk to people in law enforcement, here's some things they say where I think we can have some sympathy for them in terms of the job they face. So one is that on telephones, we have had wiretaps going back for 100 years. And in the 1994 CALEA law, there is a mandate for telephone equipment that it has to be made wiretap ready, that basically the if there's a court order that shows up to the phone company, that they have to be able to let law enforcement get the content. And that emphasis on a court order is something law enforcement's brought up a lot in the current debates, which is they say, look, we're not just saying we get to listen to Tom's messages. We're saying if we go to a judge and under a constitutional scrutiny and statutory scrutiny, all the predicates are there for court order, and then we get the court order and then it's just jumbled zeros and ones, then that's stopping our judicial system, properly supervised under the Fourth Amendment, from being able to catch the bad guys. That's I think, my attempt to explain how frustrating it can feel from the law enforcement side. Then you can say, well, you know, should we do something about that? And where I've come on that, you know, having sympathy for the hard jobs that intelligence and law enforcement people have, is that, unfortunately, in my view, in this realm, if you break it so that the court order can get in, you break it so that Pakistan can get in and so that the bad guys of other sorts can get in. And I do believe that to be very true, that information about computer vulnerability spreads very quickly, measured in days and weeks and not in years or centuries. And so I don't think we can break it for the good guys without the bad guys also getting in. And that's the core of why I can feel badly about the court order not working, but I don't think the solution is worth it. So that's where I come on this.
So a couple of things on that. I think your philosophical question that you started with, the you here being the questioner, is a really important one, because I think, you know, how you feel about this partly depends on what your sort of philosophical analogy is. So one possible philosophical analogy is the one that Jim Comey has sometimes used, is the safe deposit box. And he says, okay, if a bank made a safe deposit box that not even they could open, and even, you know, if you showed up with a search warrant, they couldn't open it. They, you know, it was, you know, made of, you know, gross, super strong titanium, and, you know, only the user had the key. And even, you know, if the bank had showed up, you know, was presented with a warrant, it couldn't get in. That would, you know, bother people. And, you know, this is really no different from that. Conversely, the questioners has a different philosophical model, right, which is, I have a right to speak to whomever I want. I'm a law-abiding person, and I'm allowed to take reasonable steps to secure the privacy of those communications. And there should be a presumption that I get to use technology that's available to me. And I think either of those, by the way, is a plausible, you know, philosophical starting place, but I think they lead you in very, very different directions. So to one additional note on a subsidiary point that Peter raised, how can you build systems that are secure to everybody but the people you want them to be insecure to? I'm a little bit more optimistic than Peter is on this point. And the reason has two names. One is Google and the other is Apple. So Google does not encrypt your stuff that's stored in the cloud, your Gmail, GChat. And the reason it doesn't is because it has to have access to the contents of those communications for purposes of routing ads. That's its business model, right? And we don't, most people, judging by the wild popularity of those products, don't see the inherent compromise that they've made on security as precluding the security of their Gmail account. I use, you know, Gmail, and I'm pretty comfortable with it, as are a lot of people and a lot of businesses. So Apple, which of course takes the opposite view and really, you know, aggressively markets as the people who have default encryption. They don't go through your data the way Google does. They're not a data company. They're a device company, right? Well, if you have your iCloud backup, you know, on, then they are also storing the stuff for you, and they can produce that in response to law enforcement subpoenas. And, you know, so they're also not taking the view that you're wildly insecure if you do that. Now, have there been insecurities that have arisen as a result of both of those systems? Yes. But we don't, you know, are those systems pervasively insecure as a result of the ability to produce material law enforcement? Probably not. So I think that issue is a little bit less binary than maybe Peter thinks it is.
Though a big part of it is whether whether there's going to be a legal mandate that says when things have to be openable or not. And for a lot of the, you know, in some ways, the stories about Google and Apple business model about the cloud is a sign of why going to the cloud is a good enough answer for Mr. Comey in a lot of situations. But for others, if there's an attack at a distance, if there's a particular insecurity that can be exploited at a distance, such as a bad algorithm for encryption, the problem for a lot of online things is it can be exploited at scale. So once you have, let's say, an algorithm that's being used, PGP, if it were mandated to be broken. If there's a way at a distance that the FBI can get in, then that same path is available to other people using the algorithm. For Google and Apple's data systems, they have whatever data security they have around that. It's somewhere between pretty good and very good, but by no means perfect. You know, Google has had, both of them have had known attacks that have gotten in. But it's a big complex system to break into, which is different from saying that the algorithms themselves or the basic mechanisms of communications themselves have to be insecure.
We have no questions on our lines right now. So if you press star and the pound key, you will be first in line to ask a question. Again, that is star and then the pound key.
One thing I might bring up just that hasn't come up, and people may have really different views about how important this issue is. Another dimension of the encryption battles has been that the State Department and other parts of the U.S. government have actually been very active promoting the use of effective encryption as a tool for dissent and human rights activists in China and lots of other countries. And if you think about potentially dictatorial countries, authoritarian countries, and how it is to try to have dissent and how to build up alternative views to the overbearing government, having the ability to communicate securely among people who are otherwise going to be subject to surveillance by the government is itself an important thing. And that's why, for internet freedom kinds of reasons, the other parts of the U.S. government have been way out front trying to come up with tools that could help dissidents, religious dissidents and others, you know, make their point. And part of what we're in now is this strange period where it's not the government versus citizens, but it's different parts of the government that have different goals. This sort of human rights and dissent goal is in conflict or in tension with some of the FBI law enforcement goals, for instance. There's more. It's not just the companies trying to make money after Snowden. There's a complicated set of human rights and sort of principles involved, in addition to some of the parts of the debate that get the most attention.
That's absolutely right, and there's also a complicating related factor, which is that some of those other governments, not only the repressive ones, may offer us a real test case for how these mandates might work. So after the Charlie Hebdo incidents in France, there has been a lot of interest among certain European governments, particularly Britain, in dealing with this same problem. And so one possible way for the United States to handle it is to simply not take a position at this point, but to let some of our sort of sister democratic governments, try different approaches to, you know, either impose regulatory requirements or not, and see how the companies interact with those and how big problems they solve, to what extent they solve problems and to what extent they create other problems. And so this is a sort of, you know, I guess federalist answer to would be to sort of hang back and let different flowers bloom in different ways.
Right. So MI5 in Britain was recently in the press saying they wanted to ban WhatsApp and iMessage and other end-to-end encrypted text messaging services. The Times of India reported a quite draconian proposal the Indian government was considering that would limit key length, which is something that was discussed in the 90s, but not so much more recently, and also require storage in unencrypted form of a wide variety of messages. One of the questions here is, you know, for the United States in a global system, is how much there's a choice here. If the main voice of the United States is the FBI concern, saying we want to break crypto, that emboldens UK or emboldens India to think that they're basically pulling in the same direction. But if instead the United States wants to be on the side of a strong cybersecurity in a global communication structure and wants to be on the side of having tools that enable politically different people to speak with some level of protection. You know, for those reasons and also for U.S. technological leadership, the United States could send a message that we really think effective encryption is crucial to the global telecommunications landscape. And that message has been debated. There's been leaks. The Washington Post has reported memos from the National Security Council, and the leaks came out just in the last couple of weeks, where one option that's being considered is something that was recommended by the review group that I was on. In 2013, the president created this review group on the NSA, and I was one of the five people for that. And our very clear recommendation was to encourage strong encryption because it builds the kind of global communications infrastructure that we thought would be most advantageous to the American approach rather to a nation-state-led, international telecommunications union-led way of having national rules that really get in the way of effective security and communications. So these are part of bigger global debates about the structure of the Internet and of communications, and the U.S. leadership can be on the side of effective cybersecurity, et cetera, or sort of hoping, fingers crossed, the way Mr. Comey might be, that maybe the UK will do the work for us.
One very important component of the dynamics here is, you know, how long it has been since an incident that really rattles people. The atmosphere today is very different, I think, than the atmosphere was in the immediate aftermath of the Charlie Hebdo killings. And, you know, when ISIS is sweeping across Iraq and Syria, and the FBI director is pointing out to Congress that they are also in touch with people in all 50 states of the United States and all over Europe, people react to that very differently than in periods like now, when you've had a sustained and quite successful industry and civil libertarian lobbying campaign over the last bunch of months that has really, I think, shifted the center of gravity of the administration from Comey and the intelligence community's point of view to the State Department and Commerce Department's point of view. And I think the memos that Peter alludes to that were reported in the Washington Post really show that movement. You know, that's a pendulum that shifts back and forth within the government, depending kind of on how nervous people are at any given moment about, you know, what's being said in those WhatsApp communications.
We do have one caller on the line waiting patiently to ask a question. We'll go to that call, but first, let me remind everyone else, we will have time to take more than just one more call, so please hit star and the pound key if you have a question.
This is Jack from Virginia, and I wanted to bring up a couple of comments of Mr. Whittaker. Earlier, you mentioned about the cat-and-mouse game that perhaps currently goes on, and I guess I would venture to guess has gone on ever since there was a crime and someone pursuing who the criminal might be. So I'm not sure that that's a very compelling reason for the kind of significant and perhaps unalterable change that's being proposed. Also, it just makes me wonder about what I would call the lowest common denominator approach to the privacy of free citizens in a free country, purportedly free country. And I'm very sympathetic with the desire to apprehend and to appropriately punish those who've committed crimes. But I'm even more zealous about protecting my neighbors, who I think have some reason to believe that at some point the government that they help support and choose may not necessarily have their best interests in heart, at heart or in mind. And going back to the comments of the fellow from Greensboro, what I'd be interested in is which of those two values do the callers think is more important, and particularly as it relates to conflating interests of national security with domestic law enforcement.
Wow, so there's a lot there. Let me try to unpack it a little bit. So first of all, when I said cat and mouse game, I didn't mean the cat and mouse game of law enforcement and individuals with, you know, who were suspected of crimes. That's been going on, as you say, from the first time there was a law enforcement agency that investigated a crime that somebody didn't want to get caught for. What I was referring to was just the number of different modalities of electronic communications that are available to you. So if you think about how investigations used to work, you know, you could find out what somebody was doing by kind of following them and talking to their friends and the people that they talked to, and you could watch them. And then we developed, you know, postal systems, and you had to, if you wanted to, you know, find out what somebody was doing, you also had to, you know, look at their written communications. And then we developed, you know, telephones, and all of a sudden you could talk remotely to people in other cities, and that was a modality of communications that you had to keep track of as well. Now we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of modalities of communications, both within devices and between devices. So, you know, you have, if you just think about how many different devices that you have that can send a message, and how many different means of sending a message using each of those devices that you have. And now you think of a law enforcement agency that needs to follow you, and how many different modes of communication, some encrypted, some not, that you have the ability to move between. And that was the cat and mouse game that I was referring to. It's just the cat and mouse game of, you know, different modes of communications that if you're serious about watching somebody, you have to keep track of. I agree with you that one necessary capacity of empowering government to do those things and to limit the ability of industry to implement strong encryption systems is that you create more capacity for abuse than you have if the government does not have those abilities, and more capacity to, you know, menace people's liberty for reasons that may have nothing to do with, you know, crimes or terrorism or other things that we would want investigated, but, you know, to do with perpetuating authority and you know, other invidious motives. And that is actually why I am not on board at this point with, you know, big limitations or even small limitations on the deploying of encryption, because it's not clear to me that the security benefits of it outweigh the security risks. My point is simply that we should not take seriously the problem, and we should appreciate that the decision to allow law enforcement and intelligence communities to go dark on some of these technologies will have significant security costs, just as the decision to regulate to avoid that would also have certain security costs.
Yeah, I'll just briefly make a couple points to Jack's provocative question. This is Peter. So one is that we've had this tension between privacy in a free society and between government achieving goals, including public order and military goals, since the birth of the Republic. And the Fourth Amendment's an attempt, and the Fifth Amendment are attempts to try to find ways to have reasonable searches that don't become general warrants and the rest. But we've had this tension, you know, ever since we've tried to have democracy and republican forms of government. In terms of how I think about it, and this is talked about a lot in the review group report that we did about the NSA, is that we have this global communications infrastructure that we're going to use around the world, the internet and related phone calls and stuff like that. And it's trying to do different goals. It's trying to do business. It's trying to do free speech. It's trying to do surveillance when it's appropriate. And one of the concerns we had about the NSA was that if they could do it, they were doing it to some extent in the period before the Snowden revelations. And that's basically a way of thinking, how much do you want to optimize all our communications for surveillance? And I think there's a lot of reasons to have other voices in the room and other perspectives rather than surveillance and law enforcement only when you're coming up with your global information infrastructure. So when it comes to cybersecurity, encryption is the best, most broad purpose way to get communication security. And that's super important when we're acting at a distance and bad people want to try to come at us. So I think of it as not one or the other. I think, how do we build an overall infrastructure? And I'm comforted that I think that law enforcement can get the things they need to get to do an effective job, sometimes without getting everything they want, but they can get enough of what they want that they can be effective at their jobs. There's going to be pain in individual cases, but I don't think that's nearly the pain we'd have if we don't have good basic cybersecurity for a lot of our communications.
Well, I don't see any additional questions on the line here. If you do have one, please hit star and the pound key, and we'll try to get to you as fast as we can. But seeing none, Mr. Wittes, do you have a closing comment?
I mean, I think I've said everything I want to say. I guess the big takeaway message is that this is an area we tend to frame as, you know, privacy versus security or liberty versus security. This is really an area where there are significant security costs on both sides of the equation and significant liberty costs on both sides of the equation. If you're the person who, you know, can't get a crime against them meaningfully investigated, that's actually a liberty issue in a free society. And so I think this is really one of those areas that's really going to, it's going to divide conservatives, it's going to divide liberals, and it really does come down to a kind of how communitarian an ethos and how individualistic an ethos you want the internet to have. And I think there's sort of no correct answer to that. There's just costs and benefits to different arrangements.
It looks like we do have one caller trying to get in a buzzer beater question here. So, caller, please do try to keep your question very to the point, and we'll see if we can answer it in the 3 minutes we have left.
Okay, in brevity, because this is my second question, but you touched on the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, and I am embattled in an FTC versus LabMD fight with an administrative agency. I'm the CEO of that company. It really boils down to the government using stolen data through a violation of cybersecurity and also unripe laws in a civil action. And I think, again, the public doesn't understand how these protections are more in criminal. And when you have these agencies outside of the NSA or the CIA or that going after companies based on things like this, it does create a bigger picture problem. I guess maybe that's more of a comment since I didn't know we just had 3 minutes. But I think that's exactly where we start getting into the goop as far as Americans' expectations and then their overreactions to things. And we cut our nose off to spite our face and national security.
Any 30-second reactions to that comment before we give Professor Swire the last word here?
Nope.
I don't know the facts of the case well enough. I've heard people passionately argue both sides of the case, and I don't myself have had enough access to have a view. I might do my little wrap up. So just in terms of the encryption, on my website, which is peterswire.net, I have quite a few writings over the years on encryption matters. So if you're interested, you can find those. And I do think I think it's more than just liberty versus liberty or security versus security why we've seen the debate play out the way it has. In the 90s, there was a period where the NSA and the FBI and the Attorney General were winning in the interagency debates. And then by the late 90s, it shifted. And I think that Director Comey got out front and made a strong case on a sense of what was painful to law enforcement. But I don't think it's some sort of accident of lobbying about why the proposals haven't moved forward from that view. I actually think this is one time where the substance of the debate comes out the way it comes out, which is we need strong encryption to do our cybersecurity, and the actual ways you would try to regulate it are worse than not regulating. And I think as people spend more time in the arguments and see arguments number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, why the policies wouldn't work, I think the substance of those arguments is a big reason why in the interagency debates over time, as happened in the 90s, the law enforcement people who had the upper hand originally, once they faced the actual realities of what these things are like, it ended up tipping towards the combination of freedom and commerce and human rights and awareness of the technology that that led to us not having these kind of mandated vulnerabilities.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Mr. Wittes and Professor Swire and the audience for their time this afternoon. We'll hope you'll join us on our next call tomorrow at noon and regularly check our schedule of teleform calls at fedsoc.org/teleform. But until tomorrow, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.